Good evening, everyone. We're broadcasting live February something. February 9th, 2016. And tonight's quote is about the senses. Now, this is a meditation quote. Bhaitabang etasa sukhasati vadami. This happiness is to be feared, I say. So the quote goes that there are five kama guna. Kama means sensuality, guna means strands is interesting. I don't think it means strands. Groups is a common translation. No? Or maybe it's not groups because let me see here. Oh, it can mean a cord. Yeah. Five binds maybe then, right? But kamaguna is just means sensual pleasures, but let's suppose that it means strands, that it means things that you're bound to, that we wrap ourselves up in, or we get wrapped up in, we get tied up in, and we get bound by, and we're bound to, we're slaves to. So there are those material shapes that we see with the eye, pleasant, liked, enticing, connected with sensual pleasures, alluring. Sounds cognizable by the ear, smells cognizable. So sounds that you hear with the ear, smells you smell with the nose, tastes with the tongue, touches with the body, all agreeable, pleasant, liked, enticing, connected with sensual pleasures. Itta kanta ma mana papiya rupa kamu pasamita Rajaniya is an interesting word. Okay, Raja means enticing. Rajaniya. Rajaniya actually does come from Raja. No. Raja? Strange. Not Raja. Raja. Rajas. Itta manapa, delightful. So it starts off quite nice, actually. It starts off quite favorable for towards sensuality. But that changes at the end of the quote. But this is an important part of Buddhism, important part of the Buddha's teaching that you see throughout. He recognizes, the Buddha recognizes the kama nisangsa, the benefits, the good in sensual pleasure. Not exactly the good, because you have to be careful, but that's really what anisangsa means, the benefit or the profit, kind of, you know, the benefit, really. It's acknowledging the fact that pleasure is pleasurable, pleasure is desirable, is itta manapa. It's something that is desired, it is something that is, that pleases the mind. But well, anyway, so clearly this is a part of the truth. The truth is, these things are pleasurable. When you see things that you like, that's pleasurable. When you hear things, there are certain sounds that are pleasurable. There's no question, this is part of the truth. But if that were all of the truth, then that'd be fine, but it's missing a key component, is the undeniable fact that this pleasure doesn't lead to happiness. Or, put simply, it doesn't even lead to more pleasure. So there's a problem, the problem that you can't always get what you want. And I guess more to the point that wanting things makes not getting things more difficult. So the Buddha recognized three things in regards to sensuality. First, the anisangsa, the benefit, and the second, the danger, kamadinava, the negative aspect, the problem, really, the problem with sensuality. And thirdly, kama, I think it's nisarana, you know, the leaving behind, or the getting out of, the freeing oneself from the trap of kama, of sensuality. So you wouldn't need the third one. There wouldn't be any need to do anything to fix the problem if there weren't a problem with sensuality, but there is. And it kind of puts you in a, I guess you could say, a catch-22 sort of situation. I don't know if that's even a proper usage of that, but you either do without sensuality, you deny yourself sensuality, and suffer as a result, or you seek out sensuality and suffer as a result. So it's like the only way to be free from the problem with the pleasure is to give up the pleasure entirely. And that kind of thinking, it sounds reasonable. And it's probably those sorts of lines of reasoning that keep people tied to sensuality, intellectually anyway. I mean, there's more to do more viscerally in terms of just being addicted. But intellectually, we think, well, you know, I don't even want to give these things up because it's the best I can do, right? The only alternative is to give them up entirely. Well, at least I get them sometimes. And so we have this I guess you could say short-sightedness. I don't know, I mean, if this were all there was, if it's true that that was the best you could do, and a measure of one's happiness was indeed how much pleasure one got, then absolutely that would be the best way to go. And so that's how people, that's how general Indian society in the time of the Buddha looked at this sort of thing. I mean, it was a big, it's always been sort of a theme running in Hinduism, sensual pleasures, or not necessarily, but bliss and happiness is excuse me, is the height. And so it's just a matter of finding the most refined form of bliss. Now, spirituality in India, and I guess you could say spiritual Hinduism, it does tend to be fairly steeped in sensual pleasure, but at its highest, it denounces sensual pleasure, but it denounces it in favor of meditative pleasures, like the bliss of meditation. And Buddhism falls into that as well. There's a lot of Buddhist teachers who emphasize the bliss aspect of meditation. And I mean, not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that, with that pleasure. In fact, there's nothing wrong with pleasure in general, just as there's nothing wrong with pain either. But the danger doesn't come with the pleasure, right? As we all know, the danger comes, and this is the catch, is that it comes from liking it. So the only way to be free from the suffering that comes with the things you want is to stop wanting them entirely. And then you're like, well, what good is it? But this kind of, you know, so this kind of thinking actually points out the whole absurdity of the whole system, or the, at least the inconsistency or the unsustainability, that it just doesn't work as a system. And if it was all there was, it's actually quite depressing, I think. You know, you meet people who have pleasant lives and they're able to live with a lot of pleasure throughout their lives. They're able to put aside their sufferings and, in general, have a positive outlook on life. There are other people who are not able to do that. And there's some sense that it's, the scientists see that it's a precondition, or it's a predilection, or they would say genetic, but it's something that we're born with. Different people have different types of brains. Some people's brains are more inclined towards pleasure. It's like, good for them, right? But when you see these people, or even if you disregard, you usually don't think about the brain aspect. You see people who seem to be doing quite well, and it really supports this idea that if only, right? If only I could get to that point. If only I could be like them. Often we look at people and they seem so happy and we think, wow, you know, they're so happy. We feel generally bad about ourselves because we're not that happy. And then it turns out that deep down inside they're actually suffering quite a bit, and that's also the case. But no, the danger is, I mean, and the real horror of it, the Buddha actually uses very strong language. He says it should not be pursued, developed, or emphasized. It is a happiness to be feared, I say. Bhayita, I think is the word, right? Bhayitabhang, right? Bhayitabhang etasa sukhasa. There should be fear of this suffering, of this happiness. There should be fear of this sukha. It's because of the results of pursuing it. And there's so many ways of explaining that. I mean, the results of consuming. Let's look at the results of consumerism, how it destroys the earth. The results of competition, because eventually it does become a competition. The more you want, once your addictions become diverse enough, you begin to encroach and encroach upon the desires of others. And that's how wars are started. Believe me, all these religious wars or whatever, they're not religious or ideological. It's all greed. Mostly to sell money, the weapons industrial complex or whatever, to win elections, etc., etc. I mean, there's so much insanity and surrounding. I mean, meaning that so much horror that comes from greed because of competition and how it intoxicates the mind. You can't see straight. You can't think straight. Sorry, when you're intoxicated, or when you want something, this is what causes us to step all over other people. This is what causes us to go beyond competition and into outright manipulation and oppression, etc., etc. It's how most political systems wind up. The people on top end up crushing the people on bottom to get what they want. And once they've got what they want, to get more than, you know, to keep up with their wants, to keep up with their ever-increasing wants. It's actually obscene. And most simply, I mean, these are all good examples of the results of pursuing these. But the most simple, and really the core for Buddhism, is the idea that it's ever that the desires are ever increasing, and the pleasure is ever decreasing. And so, anytime, and this is inherent in the system. So anytime you like a pleasure, pleasure comes and you like it, you've entered into a system of diminishing returns that inevitably leads you to dissatisfaction, because it doesn't sustain itself. Pleasure doesn't bring more pleasure. Now, many people are on the upswing and they can live their lives quite well, but I think we have to examine. I mean, this is actually an important point, looking at people who are happy all the time, because it throws a monkey wrench in the Buddhist philosophy, or it seems to. But there's two points that can't be ignored. One is that could come to an end at any time. You know, at the least a person can change. There's no sense that is a permanent thing. In fact, the brain can even change. But no, more that it doesn't work as a theory. It just makes you lucky, for example. So if we ignore the whole idea that a person can change, if we say, well, someone is lucky, even before we get to the idea that they may not always be able to find the pleasure, no? I mean, they could get into a situation, and in fact they will, because they're cultivating it. I mean, it ends up being a game of Frogger, kind of, where you're always jumping from one pleasure to the next and ignoring the fact that it's sinking underneath you, and that one day you're going to get stuck on a sinking piece of ice. You ever played Frogger? But even still, if we ask how do we end suffering, if we look at a general sense of how to end suffering, it can't be by ensuring that everyone gets pleasure, because it's not going to happen. There's you can't ensure this. The world, accidents happen, if nothing else. Acts of nature, natural disasters. How do you cope with Haiti or... what was the tsunamis in Japan and the earlier one in all over Southeast Asia? How do you deal with sickness, old age, death? It's not a system that works. It's not an answer to the problems of life to just keep getting more and more and more. And so it actually relates to the other problems, is that even someone who's always happy, they're destroying the earth. You know, they're always, this is what consumers today are doing. We're setting ourselves up for trouble. And what we've just done is look to the next 50, 60, 70, 80 years and said, okay, well, I can sustain it that long and then I'll die and that's it. And usually I'll go to heaven according to my religion, because I believe in God, etc., etc. Or that's it, if you don't believe in an afterlife. And so we abuse our situations to the best of our ability, squeeze as much life out of it as we can, and in the end, we leave with nothing except our desires. But we figure, well, I've lived a good life, right? And so what we've seen is a degradation of the earth as a result. And surprise, surprise, we keep coming back, and it keeps getting worse and worse, and we're digging ourselves deeper and deeper into the pit. And, you know, the system breaks eventually, even if you are able to stay on the upswing. I mean, for many people, it's already broken. People who were greedy in their past lives are then the poor people in their next lives, the people without in the next lives. If they're manipulative, if they're combative, then they can be born in hell. You know, you go to a bad place out of greed. It can lead you to terrible things. I mean, there's so many things we could talk about if we start talking about Buddhist ideas of karma and rebirth. Because obviously desire is not going to... It's an important point, is that desire is not going to lead you to a good rebirth. How do we know this without basing it on faith? You can see it in this life. A person who engages in sensual addiction becomes progressively more and coarser and coarser in their desires in order to try and... evoke the same feeling, because you need more, but not only more, you need coarser desires. You need something more sharp, more harsh, more animalistic, you might say, right? I think that's a good word to use, because if you look at animals, in some ways they're an extension of many of our paths. And so this is an easy way to see how you were born as a dog or a cat. Or worse, their desires are so coarse and so base. I'm going to get in trouble because I'm insulting cats. But so some thoughts on sensuality. Obviously, this is what we look at in meditation. And the most important point that you could say about it is that none of this is to be taken on faith or to influence you in your beliefs. If anything, it's to challenge you, because a lot of this, for many people, doesn't feel comfortable or pleasant to hear, right? It's not something we want to hear. And you're not supposed to swallow the bitter pill and say, okay, well, he's probably right and I'm probably wrong. That's not how Buddhism works. This is to challenge you. These are bold claims, I think. I mean, the claim that the Buddha makes is certainly bold, that sensual pleasure is to be feared. You can challenge him on that. You're supposed to challenge that. You're supposed to approach that from a perfectly neutral point of view and test it. Look at the evidence, not your logic or reasoning, but actually look and observe how pleasure works. And that's what meditation's about, observing. So when you want something, saying to yourself, wanting. When you feel pleased, saying to yourself, happy, or pleased. When you liking. When you want, wanting. And look at the results as well. When you feel upset because you don't get, when you feel stressed because you have to strive for, you have to work for, look at that as well. Eventually you'll see the truth. It's not intellectual. You'll just see it. It's as though it's right in front of you. You'll say, wow, this is really hurting me. And you'll just let it go. It won't even be a logical, this is hurting me, therefore I should let it go. It'll just be seeing the useless, seeing what's right there, what we can't see, how useless it is, how harmful it is. Showing ourselves, in a sense, because intellectually we often know that our addictions are harmful. Meditation shows us that. So we show ourselves that. See, I told you, the brain knew. You're showing your mind, showing your heart. So, that's the Dhamma for tonight. We got some people on the Hangout. I'd like to express my appreciation for our two meditators. They're working very hard here, doing intensive practice, many hours a day. But that's so... everyone sadhu to them. But you can go continue with your practice. So who do we have here? Bobby, Dar, Larry, Simon. Who has questions? And you really should have headphones if you come on the Hangout, because as you can see, you're echoing me. No, I don't have headphones, so I'm a hypocrite, but... better if you have headphones, or else if your mic is far away. My mic is probably okay because it's far away from the speakers. Test, or maybe it wasn't. Test. Yeah, no, it's not my mic. Does anyone have questions this evening? I just came by to say hi.
Hey, I've got a question comment, Monte. I guess the predicament with, you know, you're speaking of pleasures and people in the upswing. They're unconscious of their predicament. They're unaware. You know, they're trapped in their own.
Right.
Ignorant, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's, gosh, it just is sad. Where is their out? They just have to be fortunate enough to come across someone or some circumstance or you know, some learning, something mm-hmm. to hear or see to kind of, so to speak, wake up. Otherwise, they're just swimming in their ignorance.
Yeah.
It's scary.
That samsara, I mean, we're a part of samsara. We're a whole sea of ignorance and meaninglessness. I mean, it's not really a problem. You can just stay in samsara. It's just, it turns out to be meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hold a view that samsara is somehow good. I mean, you can, people do. But it's not tenable. There's lots of ways of poking holes in that argument. And that's what leads Buddhists to say, well, leaving samsara actually in the end is preferable. But it's a long path. As you say, you have to come across, but you have to go logically step by step. You can't say, you know, you're wallowing in a sea of delusion. You can't say that samsara is meaningless. I mean, here I go saying these things, but I want to qualify. I have to qualify it by saying all of that is impossible to see unless you've seen these first things. And if you see these first things, by first things I mean you see how your desires are causing you suffering. You see how you're causing, you say, I'm suffering, why am I suffering? And you look and you see why you're suffering. Once you start to see why you're suffering, the rest is like, why does B follow A? I mean, why does 2 follow 1? It's a natural progression. You get to Nibbana without any doubt, without any need to, without any concern, is this the right path? Is it right to attain Nirvana? So I think people are often turned off by the idea of having to give up all sensuality, having to leave samsara behind, never to be reborn, never to see the things that they love. You know, it's putting the cart before the horse. It's looking at things that you don't understand, that you can't understand. It's not possible. You can't think enough and you'll understand them. You really have to go step by step or you'll never appreciate. It's impossible to appreciate Nirvana. Impossible to appreciate Nirvana until you've gone the steps and seen how it's not a question of, you know, it's not up for debate. You can't argue based on experience against leaving samsara. It just has to come step by step, which is why it's so important to get people to meditate. Not to talk too much about this kind of theory, but to get them to meditate. And once they're meditating, you can talk about this kind of theory, and challenge them, and have them see how they react. Oh, you want me to give up my pleasure? You see, you have an attachment, you have stress. If I say stop attaining pleasure, stop looking for pleasure, that injunction is stressful. Now, why is that? You know, this kind of thing. If you're really, you know, if it's really wholly good, then just stop doing it. Stop attaining it. Stop going for it, right? Stop striving for it. If you do, you'll feel stress. You'll feel terrible, really. Withdrawal. So that's the state we live in. We're in constant. It's fearsome in that way as well. It's fearsome because you're being chased by withdrawal, and you have to always outrun these demons of desire. If you ever fall behind, they start to bite your heels. That's why it's fearsome. Okay, no questions? Who is this Dar? Is that Dar from Second Life? Who is Dar?
Hi. What's the point of all of this? Like, you know, the greed, the anger, the jealousy, the whatever, the lust. What's the point of it all? You're all just going to end up dead. So, like, why do we have so much, like, attachment to these things, I guess?
Well, bad habits. We cultivate them habitually. I mean, think of how you were when you were a kid. We may have come into the world with some emotions, greed particularly. Kids, I think, have, well, greed and anger and delusion. But putting that aside, think of how your parents treated you. Think of how your friends treated you. Think of what neuroses and, you know, how we develop as kids. We develop bad habits. I mean, I guess you can't totally separate it from what came before, because the reason we develop them is out of ignorance and out of bad habits already, you know. Our ego, so self-esteem, this is how kids get low self-esteem when they're bullied, when they're assaulted, you know, when these sorts of things happen, but just about everything. When we're picked on, when we're shunned socially, when we are teased, you know. So they magnify, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Why are we so steeped in these things? Is habits. We built them up. We came into this world with them. We came into this birth with them. But we developed them. And they go up and down, right? So sometimes we're born with very little greed or anger or delusion. Sometimes we're born with a lot, and it goes out. And we cultivate whatever during this life, good or bad. And so it's like an ocean rolling around. There's no point to it. There's no meaning to it. There's no samsara, or the universe has no meaning, has no purpose. That idea that it has a purpose is solely based, I would say, solely based on our, or primarily anyway, I don't know solely, but primarily based on our misguided belief that there is a creator God. That there is someone up there with a plan, because when we build things, there's a reason for building them, right? They have a purpose. Even if it's just a sand castle to look nice. That's actually, Hinduism is kind of like that. I think God created the world just in play, for fun, kind of. I'm probably totally butchering the Hindu religion, but there's those elements of just doing it for fun. But even that is a purpose, and it comes from God, from the idea that there's a creator. Now that's erroneous, fallacious. There's no evidence. There's no. There's no reason to think that. So pragmatically speaking, or empirically speaking, there's no obvious reason for the rhyme or reason for the universe, and therefore for us, for life. You know, what's the purpose of life? It's the wrong question. The better question is, how do I be happy? I think, because it's about us, you know. It speaks to us, you know, to what we want. We want to be happy, rather than speaking to some intellectual concept that ends up being meaningless.
Well, is it? I keep coming back to the you know, the I want to be happy. It seems like it's maybe contradictory to I want to, or I should want to participate with life and nature in a good, wholesome, and a skillful way, which would, if done, that promotes happiness, but not just for myself, but for more, for others. I have a problem sorting through that.
Why is you don't think that leads to happiness?
Well, it's almost like it's much more than just an individual thing.
I see.
We're all part of something much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Both in the short term and in the long term, eternal. I'm not sure that I even understand eternal, but it's, you know, it's just that seems like there's got to be a participatory approach to everything to make it meaningful. I may just be trying to attach meaning to something that can't have meaning attached to it. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the thrust of the, you say it's the trouble that you're having, but I mean, empirically, there's a difference between the happiness that comes from doing good things with a good heart, or even just having a good heart, and the happiness that comes from wanting.
Mm-hmm.
It's empirically different. One is unadulterated, that's the mm-hmm. idea. Altruism is... I've talked about altruism as well, but the kind of concept of altruism is actually quite selfish or self-centered, because you do it because it makes you happy. It doesn't have to be, actually. That's what's true. I mean, the problem with altruism is when you feel like you should do it. You feel an obligation to do it. And you feel kind of bad because you lost something. I give you something, but, well, I really wanted it, so it makes me feel bad inside. It's, that's still considered to be a good thing because you're training in it, and eventually it becomes more comfortable and you start to change your greed, you start to lose your greed. You see the suffering inherent in greed. But that's really the point, is that the true benefit of altruism is that it reduces your greed. It reduces your selfishness, it reduces your ego, it reduces your anger, it reduces your defilements, right? When you're patient with someone, when you could just lash out and say, why are you taking so long? Why are you so, why don't you understand this? Why don't you, whatever. When you're patient instead, it reduces your anger. When you want something and instead you be patient with it, it helps to reduce your greed. And so the outcome is peace. The outcome is more contentment, which is a much more lasting and stable and unadulterated happiness. I mean, it sounds so dull, really, that when you give up all pleasures, you're without, right? But that's not really how it is at all. You're so happy. You feel free. It's like you've got this big weight lifted off your shoulders where, I don't care what happens. I'm not bothered by it one bit. So people say, what if this happens? Like, okay. That's what it's like. It's so free, you know, that's the point. When you have attachment, you're vulnerable to outcomes.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, there's lots. I mean, it's good to talk about these things because these are hard concepts. Of course, because we're so steeped in desire, These are hard concepts to talk about, and it's important because logically we're deluding ourselves. If you look at it intellectually, it helps you to see that, you know, we're really deluding ourselves, and that does help you push to practice. I mean, it helps you sort of gain confidence in what you're doing, and the importance of mental clarity, of mental cleansing, cleaning the mind like we clean the body, right? Should be a daily thing.
Here's my question. We all know we're going to die one day, so like that's what I'm asking. Like, why be greedy? Why be, you know, lusty? Why be jealous?
Mm-hmm.
We all know we're going to die one day, but yet we still can't, like, help ourselves, I guess? I don't know.
You're preaching to the choir. Why? I mean, if you want an answer, my guess, why? I mean, it's ignorance, delusion. We are not conscious enough to understand what you're saying. You know, I mean, intellectually, it's great, but we're not conscious, we're not awake enough. That's really it. We're half asleep. Meditation, you feel more awake, more alert, more able to see what you kind of know intellectually anyway, but you're too asleep to really put it into effect. You know, people who are angry will feel guilty after they lash out. People who are greedy will feel guilty after they indulge. People who are arrogant, conceited, will, I think, often feel guilty anyway. Maybe not all the time, but we do have that. And that's kind of a sign that we're kind of awake. If you don't have guilt at all, I suppose you could say you're totally asleep. That's the most dangerous. But if you feel bad about it, then that's better, because at least you're kind of conscious that you're on a bad path. But we're just not awake enough to stop it, to really get it, to really see clearly. So we've got this sort of cerebral thing going on where we know it's wrong, but our heart, the core of who we are, is on autopilot. You know, getting. It's kind of scary. That's the whole thrust of the quote tonight. It is kind of scary how animalistic we can become. We lash out when we're angry. We don't even have time to think about whether we should or shouldn't. So I say habit and ignorance, or this veil of delusion that keeps us as though we were asleep. Ye pamatta yatha matta. A negligent person or a heedless person is as though already dead.
Well, and mention was made of, you know, we're going to die. You know, we basically, everyone knows, you know, we see it in everyday life. Everyone's going to die. And the healthy contemplation of death, which is really easy to avoid, and really uncomfortable, but it what little bit I've tried to do does seem to go a long way.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, those kind of meditations certainly bring conviction, because they start to change your views. You say, right. You change your priorities, you know.
Mm-hmm. And consideration of death is one thing that the Western culture is not good at.
Mm. Among many things, but yeah.
Yeah.
No, but it's a very good point, is that we have, spiritually, we haven't, I think, evolved very well in that regard. There are other, well, I mean, Buddhism played a big part in that, for sure, in Asia. Hinduism, I guess, as well, does talk about death. But, yeah.
Well, and so many of us have grown up in the in Christian or quasi-Christian tradition, which goes a long way towards allowing one to avoid such contemplations,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Right. Although I suppose you could probably argue that cultural Christian societies probably were more conscious. I mean, I guess I would speculate that part of our inability to deal with these kind of deep spiritual questions is not having a deep spirituality in the West. America was sort of founded fairly secularly, right? It was, if you compare to Europe, everyone was running away from organized anything, including religion. So when people talk about Canadian culture, I just kind of laugh. What do you mean? We don't have any culture. We do. It's kind of quaint. I mean, we have Tim Hortons. That's our culture. You guys have McDonald's. I mean, that's culture. It's,
yeah.
It's not, so it just may be our, but anyway, kind of off track. The point being that, but it's a good point that these kind of meditations are things that should come to the West, along with the rest of Buddhism. Contemplation of death is something. Charity, I suppose. I don't know how common that is in the West. And actually, see, the funny thing is, Buddhists always complain about this, and they have been for a long, long time, and it may have been worse before. And they would say, you know, Buddhism's not going to survive in the West because people aren't charitable enough. They aren't kind enough. And people were saying, you know, if you want to start a monastery here, or you want to start a meditation center, you have to charge for it. You can't be a monk, certainly. But moreover, you have to, you know, you have to think in terms of capitalist concepts. And so this is, I'm not, you know, I'm always hesitant to bring up charity because, of course, it is, you know, we do rely on it, and so it sounds like I'm kind of somehow obsessed or concerned with this, but not really, not at all. This is something that you hear Buddhists talk about a lot, and in the West it is a common criticism, and it's kind of absurd to me. It's not really true. There isn't certainly the same religious fervor that you find in Buddhist societies. But people are so, you know, it's so awesome. I mean, look at this community, look what we've done, right? Small, we're not huge, and it's not like we have resources to burn or anything, but the fact that we can do so much for free, on a small scale, but can do, is, and with no problem. And moreover, what I was thinking is how it cultivates that sort of, I'm shy away from the word fervor, but kind of fervor in the sense of confidence and you know, just as with the awareness of death, the awareness of charity as a religious practice. As a part of your practice as a Buddhist, for example, it just comes. So when people often say, I mean, it's the whole field of dreams. If you build it, they will come. Kind of, you have to. You can't expect people to be religious before you teach them, or before you introduce them to the religion. Now, this is totally off track from what you were talking about death, but probably you could make an argument that it's merely from a lack of being in touch with enlightened beings. It's not an East versus West thing. In my mind, a lot of it isn't East versus West. It's just Buddhism versus no Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if you want to be a little bit more charitable, Buddhist type religions or spiritual, deeply spiritual religions versus not deeply spiritual religions. I mean, I don't personally find theistic, monotheistic religions to be all that spiritually fulfilling. Now, I'm obviously they find them to be feeling, but I just mean to say it's kind of simple. You know, you believe in God, you go to heaven. For many people, that's their religion. Or at best, you do a bunch of meaningless rituals. I mean, meaningless in the sense of, to us meaningless, but to God meaningful. We do them because God wants us to do them. That's what the priest tells us, right? That kind of thing. I mean, it's fairly simplistic. So, you know, where's the spirituality in that? Where's the contemplation of death? You know, what is death to, say, a Christian? Well, death is the moment where my faith is transformed into a heavenly afterlife, eternal afterlife. I mean, it's a very simplistic way of looking at death. It totally avoids the fact that when you die, your life flashes before your eyes, and you might go to hell. You know, even if you've been a good Christian, and even if that were the way, at the last moment, you might suddenly get scared and think and forget about God. And if you forget about God in that last moment, surprise, surprise, he can't save you. Not that that actually does lead to heaven, but if your mind is in a bad place when you die. I mean, it's just, if you compare it to the Buddhist concept of death and how we actually look at death and dealing with death and becoming, the importance of becoming comfortable with death, it's a whole other type of religion. So, the world is, you know, we often are big doom and gloom, and especially doom and gloom about modern society, but the world is clearly contains good and bad elements to it. And we should never be blind to either. That's just my take on it.
So the good and bad, that's a dichotomy.
Yeah.
And I'm presuming that Nibbana is something beyond dichotomies and dualism.
You're right. Yeah.
We have to talk. Yeah. You know, you teach in the world of dualism and dichotomies, but there's something beyond.
Well, non-dualism isn't such a big problem in Theravada Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Non-dualism is much more Mahayana kind of thing. And in fact, it's a Hindu or an Indian concept. It's called Advaita. Non-dualism is Advaita. There's a whole school called Advaita Vedanta. It's not Buddhist, but they share that with those schools of Buddhism. So it's not really about non-dualism, but you're correct. I mean, absolutely, our form of Buddhism as well describes Nibbana as being beyond good and evil, or at least frames it in that way. And there's a curious corollary question as to the fact that Nibbana is uncreated, it's unformed, it's unconditioned. Well, if it's unconditioned, how do you attain it, right? How do you bring it about? How do you bring about the experience of Nibbana? It's really not that hard to understand, because Nibbana is cessation. And of course, cessation has no good or evil in it. But at the same time, there are certain things that bring you closer to cessation. It's like, suppose we're tied up in a harness and we've got ropes stretching out to all sorts of hooks on the walls, and we're being suspended over a pit. Well, how do you reach the ground? By cutting all the ropes. Now, the ropes don't have anything to do with the ground, and cutting the ropes doesn't actually create the ground. It doesn't have anything to do with that. But the act of cutting the ropes, and this is like letting go of your attachments, gets you closer to that point where you're going to fall. Or are you going to be free? I mean, you could look at it another way. If you're a bird tied down by ropes, if you cut, the more ropes you cut, the closer you are to being free. And when you finally cut that last one, you can fly. So goodness doesn't create Nibbana, but it creates the conditions, or it does away with the conditions by which we are kept out of Nibbana, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got all these conditions that are keeping us from Nibbana, keeping us from cessation, because we're constantly creating more and more, so there's more arising. It's quite simple. It's not like it's really hard to understand why Nibbana is special, why it's an exception. It's the only possible exception, because it's cessation.
Heavy.
Who do we have new? Guadalupe. Oh, hi.
Hi.
I don't think we've met face to face yet.
No. I went to ask you about how to overcome greediness from other people. I mean, the thing is, I came to USA to do my PhD, and I entered into a very greedy environment, but I found difficult to stand all these people, and I think I have developed a kind of aversion from greedy people. So I just want advice about that.
About greedy people?
Yeah, about how to deal with them.
Well, mindfulness. Try to stay away from them for sure, but when you can't, I mean, consider that no one can get in here. No one can get inside. They can only get to here and here and here and here and here and here. But they can only get to the sense doors. They can't get inside. So if someone says something to you, that's just hearing. If someone does something to you, it's just an idea, it's just thinking. If you see someone, it's just seeing. You see something they do, it's still just seeing.
Sometimes it's really difficult for me because I have to follow their rules.
Mm.
For example, this idea that all your work belongs to them and not to you or to other people who is in the world is kind of crazy for me. I don't understand why should I work just for their purpose and not for the benefit of the others. You know what I mean?
Kind of. I mean, I get a lot of these questions about what should I do in my life, and there's no answer. You know, life is messed up. Yeah, some people, if you're born into a pig farmer family, you're in big trouble because you're going to get involved with killing pigs. That's really bad. I mean, there are people who are able to escape it, but I mean, that's just an extreme example. But in life, we're going to be compromised in society. Why? Because we're surrounded by people who have questionable morals. You know?
Yeah.
To say the least, most people don't think twice to lie or cheat or kill or maybe even steal. And not most people, but, you know, there's aspects of all of these in the world. So I don't have an answer for you. Really, the answer is there isn't one. To be perfectly honest, that, you know, you've got to slowly make your way out is the only way. You know, there's a story of this bird that was born, this woman who, everybody else was born in heaven, her husband and all her co-wives. This guy had 5 wives, I think. They were all born in heaven, but she was born as a bird. And when she found out they'd all been born in heaven, she refrained from eating live fish. She was a crane or something, one of these fish-eating birds. But she refrained. And so she was quite ill, quite sickly, but her whole life as a bird. I mean, it's just a fable whether you believe that that actually happened or not. That kind of allegory is very much the Buddhist way. That if you have to do evil, you'll starve to death. You know, willingly starve to death. That's a Buddhist way. You know, the only way out is out. And most of us aren't able to get to that, and therein lies the rub. We're stuck in samsara. So we do good sometimes, we do evil sometimes. The meditation will be a guide for you, but it can only be a guide if you let it. You have to follow what you see in meditation. You have to start living life. I mean, coming here and meditating is a good start, for sure. But with all these questions about how to live your life, advice for life, the reason you have such a vague question, the reason these vague questions come out is because there's no precise answer. The questions are general advice, and the reason they're like that is because there is no specific answer. It speaks to the problem of trying to keep a foot in the world. The world is flawed. And the more intensely you get involved with society, the more compromised you become. Potentially. Not all the time, but the more potential there is for being compromised. The harder it is to stay uncompromised. Because society is based on our desires to become, desires to create, desires to advance civilization, all these, it's all desire and aversion and so on. Medicine is the aversion from sickness. Anyway, it's 10 o'clock, I'm going to say goodnight. Thank you all for tuning in. Good session.
Thank you, Bhante.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.